the economic argument always interwoven. Believe it, spread the word, it's true. But if it is, why are the cuts in arts funding taking place? Well, because cutting public spending is crucial, so we're told by our coalition government, in dealing with the deficit. We may think it's a good strategy, or we may think it's a bad one. It's a free country, we're entitled to ask questions and say what we believe. So here's the question I think we need to ask. What's next? Is this a policy for now, or is it the future? When the deficit has been paid off, or half paid off, as the governments say they can in 4 or 5 years, what will happen then? What's the plan? Did they have one? We'd like to know what it is. And we're not asking because we think DCMS has been infiltrated by Philistines. Let's agree everyone's acting in good faith. But we see a clear distinction between a government that says we're cutting investment in art and culture because we have to, and one that believes that to cut it in any circumstances is always the right thing to do. So, is it pragmatics or is it ideology? We, all of us, do different things. I run a theatre. I guess there was a time, say 20 years ago, when the job of a theatre was to put on shows. We still stage shows, but these days, that's just the start of what we do. The joy of receiving the gift of public investment is that it allows us to think about why we put on shows, for whom, and created by whom. And what difference do those decisions make? And what's the greatest number of people that those shows can enrich? And in what way? It's a privilege to think and work like this. And one consequence, and perhaps the most transforming, is that, yes, in this theatre we're artists and producers and technicians all working as a team. But the team gets ever bigger and more sophisticated as we're joined by teachers, and special needs teachers, and carers, and academics, and commercial investors, and commercial producers, and social workers, and doctors, and architects, and town planners, and directors of trusts, and of foundations, and of corporations, and bankers, and lawyers, and local government folk in all their many guises. One of the pleasures for the team that put this gathering together was how easy it was, because from the first, almost everyone got it. Yeah, got it, I'm in. The whole point, and this really is the point, was to start to create an arena in which you, or we all, can speak. And I trust five ways of going forward, hopefully with government and together. So, as I'm speaking first, I can't know for sure that what I say now, I'm saying on your behalf, but I'll risk it. We are not arguing that the arts are more important than education and health. We are not arguing that in cutting public spending, arts and culture should be exempt. This is easily misunderstood, so I'll say it again. I do not think that the Young Vic is more important than the NHS. But the principal of King's College, on the other side of the river, who runs one of this country's major medical schools, is keen to talk to us on this side of the river about how working with actors and directors might help Beth, in his words, humanize the training of doctors. I do not think that my outreach team is more important than any of our local schools. But right now, right across in our Maria Theatre over there, my outreach team is preparing to meet some 60 young people from nearby special needs schools who, in an hour or two, will perform a show they have been devising over the past few months, led by my outreach team. Does our government get that? That's the question. The extraordinary range of ways in which lives are profoundly enhanced by consistent, long-term public investment in the arts. Of course, we collectively are shows and exhibitions and dance and music and opera and all the rest, and hurrah that we are. But that's not all we are, and certainly not when we join together. Arts organisations in receipt of public investment, commercial art producers, including the commercial theatre, the creative industries, education, higher education, vocational training, local government, are all part of one intensely productive organism. Attack one part of it, and the whole creature feels the pain. In the end, we all have the same objective: to create the means by which we all fulfill our potential as human beings. Believe it, spread the word, it's true. We put this meeting together fast, in under 3 weeks. We felt an urgency to do it now, before the 30th of this month, next Wednesday, when Arts Council funding announcements are made. We know every art form, every aspect of the organism isn't represented here. There were hundreds who wanted to be with us, but couldn't change their earlier commitments. We have the longest list of apologies. This is not a Young Vic event. It just happens to be happening here. This is yours. We are not running a campaign. What we want to do is think and talk together. Then talk to government. Realistically, constructively, convincingly. Thank you.
We're also being live streamed this morning around the world, so we've probably got an audience of millions watching this on the internet. So welcome to you 8 people. Just in terms of structure of this morning, the way that we're going to work it is that we're basically going to have about 45 or 50 minutes worth of contributions from speakers, and there are some great people talking with some great stories. Once we've done that, we're then going to have hopefully about 50 minutes left to have a much broader conversation. And I've asked everybody this morning to try to make contributions pithy and also focused and proactive about what next, where we're going, and to keep that in mind as our focus. So the first group of speakers I'm going to invite now to the stage are Jude, Artistic Director of the South Bank Centre, and Timmy, who is a youth worker from SE1 United, who will talk about creating a sense of place at the South Bank Centre. And Anthony, General Director of the Sage Gateshead, will talk about regeneration. And Karina, Chief Executive and Artistic Director of the Broadway, will talk about her work in Barking.
Well, good morning. We're very proud to have inherited this extraordinary space, the Festival of Britain site. You'll know, many of you, it's our 60th anniversary this year. And the statements that were made after the war about the human right to art, Article 27, were directly then reflected in how the Festival of Britain was created, with this generous idea of landscape being for everyone, of imagination belonging to each very personally and individually, but coming to light in a very vigorous and powerful way when we come together, when we collect. And in reflecting on the Festival of Britain, we're even more committed than perhaps we've ever been in carrying on pursuing a narrative that I think the arts in this country have done to the most exemplary level, in speaking positively about how do you unite the extraordinary act of personal endeavour of an artist or a collection of artists with the excitement and possibility of every individual and what they could do creatively. Putting those two stories together, what in the old-fashioned way used to be access and elitism, how do you combine those two? I think the arts and cultural sector has had the most sophisticated, complex and important discussion about that of any country anywhere in the last 25 years. And that has directly affected the way the country perceives itself and is perceived. It's not unusual to have a look at those statistics that we had on the film and realise that's come out of not government funding, but the passion of the sector to educate and encourage governments to think about what this country could look like when we work together on what we believe. So in thinking about the South Bank Centre at the moment with its generous spaces, our what next is how do you, inside those generous national spaces, make sure that they're made up of the many stories and not the few? How do you unite the great aspirations of our orchestras with the great aspirations of a young person like Timmy working locally and thinking about what his future could look like? And I think that fabric that we're all trying to weave, bringing those two big stories together, is the next big journey. We're already on it. I'm convinced we're not going to let arts funding make us take a step back philosophically. And I think that is the most important thing that I want us to hold on to, which is that arts funding is affected by the passion and effectiveness of our work. If the work is good, if it's practical, if it's real, if it has an effect, then governments listen. Governments, let's face it, are subject to the same problems of growing up in an education system that doesn't weight the arts in a favourable manner. It isn't surprising that governments, therefore, have a less attuned idea of what the arts can achieve. So changing the way the education system works, which is something we've been talking about for many years, is one of our top priorities. And changing our own attitude to young people and children. If there's one thing that I would like us to think about, what next, it's the cultural rights of children and young people. Yesterday, Dame Vivian gave a glorious gift to the nation in terms of her contribution to new opportunities for the young. If we want to adjust something, I would suggest that we adjust the way the large and small organisations work together and the way that the large people, not that I am one, but the large people work with the small people. If we could completely readjust that and have a different kind of landscape, an equal landscape of the energy of the young with the added energy of the elders, then I think we would have another new story to tell that would, again, bring convincing public funding to our spaces. So what next? Should it also include bringing our audiences, bringing our young participants, bringing the people who do love and support us, bringing them more to the fore in the arguments? Have we know how good we've got at bringing audiences to involve themselves with us and bringing participants to work with us on the arts. Have we mobilised every voice that we could in talking enthusiastically about how the arts have changed all our lives? Maybe we haven't done that enough yet. Maybe that's another what next.
It's always hard to persuade governments about the importance of art. After all, art is all the things that government isn't. Art is about the I in life, not the we. It's about the particular rather than the general. It's about private life, private feelings, rather than public life and public feelings. And as we all know, a public life that doesn't acknowledge the private is a life that isn't worth having. We all argue that the cultural industries are of enormous and growing value to the British economy, that a healthy cultural realm is a powerful reason for Britain's magnetism as a tourist attraction, that British cultural excellence is a valuable element of British identity abroad. And we argue too for the social usefulness of art, that music makes school children better at maths, or that drama makes our society more tolerant. I hope these things are true, and in many cases I've seen them with the evidence of my own eyes. But this utilitarian argument with governments takes away from art the very thing that makes it alluring. That's its mystery and its joy, its irresponsibility, if you like. A utilitarian argument for art can concede in diminishing the thing that you're arguing for. Art may improve our behaviour, it may civilise us, but art isn't an ethical medicine. The philosopher George Santayana said, "Music is useless, as life is." And it's precisely our awareness of the uselessness of life that makes us want to struggle to give it purpose and to give that purpose meaning. The arts offer us a commentary on being alive, how to make sense of the world and even how to change it. Change begins with understanding, and understanding begins by identifying oneself with another person. In a word, empathy. The arts enable us to put ourselves in the minds, eyes, ears, and hearts of other human beings. The arts are weapons of happiness. What we hold in our heads, our memory, our feelings, our thoughts, our sense of our own history, is the sum of our humanity. We carry on us what King Lear called the smell of mortality. Art redeems mortality by giving us a glimpse of eternity. It briefly illuminates something that's more than human. By diminishing the opportunity to experience the arts or to study them, we condemn future generations to a life a little less than human. The cultural life in this country, in libraries, musicians, theatres, opera houses, galleries, concert halls, cinemas and art centres, is going to be eroded in a perfect storm by Arts Council cuts, by the depletion of the training of musicians, actors and artists, and by the decision to leech the humanities for our universities. Little by little, the already large gap between those for whom the arts are part of life and those who feel excluded from them will widen to an unbridgeable divide. We ask what's next, and I reply, cultural apartheid.